So it's Erev Pesach, and I want to try to keep the Shiurim going. Not unfortunately, but fortunately due to a lot of, I won't say distractions, but giving Shiurim on Shabbos HaGadol, recording Shiurim on Parshas Mitzara, Rashi, Sfas Emes. So this series of trying to gradually cover Tzeir Lamad, which is really the core, Darish Tzeir Lamad, as the Rambam says, the core of the Haggadah. We've gotten a little bit delayed. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to jump ahead and discuss the third pasuk. I won't discuss the fourth pasuk. I'll send the link to, I've given many, many shiurim on that fourth pasuk. I strongly recommend it because that's really the pasuk about Gula. So I'll post the shiur link or a link to that shiur. But getting back to the three pasukim, remember, Parshas Kisavo contains Arami Oved Avi. It's a four-pasuk synopsis of Yitzias Mitzrayim. The four-pasuk synopsis was recited by Bikurim bringers as they entered the Beis HaMikdash. Obviously, these were people who had already lived in Eretz Yisrael, so it's people who, by definition, did not leave Mitzrayim, so they had the challenge of imagining Yitzias Mitzrayim, because they didn't experience Yitzias Mitzrayim, because they lived in Israel by bringing Bikurim. And the Haggadah disassembles each of these psukim into separate sections and segments, and interprets their meaning by citing parallel psukim in Tanakh that amplify or tweak or tease out some of the meanings. So the first pasuk, which we talked about in some of the earlier shiurim of the series, Barami Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayim Avi, Ergosham. The second pasuk describes not just the descent to Mitzrayim, but the slavery, and I spent a lot of time discussing that pasuk. Vayereu Osanu HaMitzrim Vayanunu Vayednu Leinu Vodakashas. We talked about all the different strategies, the very heinous and sinister strategies to persecute us, to enslave us, to trick us, to discriminate against us, to terrorize us, to financially terrorize us. And the third pasuk, which I just want to touch upon today and tomorrow, is the pasuk about tefillah. Vanitzaka l'Hashem, v'yishma Hashem eskalenu, v'yaras enyenu, v'yes amolenu, v'yes lachatzenu. So that's the pasuk in Kisavo. And I'll discuss today the aspect of the pasuk in Shemos, which the Haggadah quotes alongside the pasuk in Kisavo, to amplify the pasuk in Kisavo. So I'm opening my Haggadah here, one of my Haggadahs here, just to make sure I've got the pasuk right. That the Haggadah quotes the pasuk in Shemos to try to, again, elaborate, Vanitzak al Hashem, Kimashin Emar, Vayihi, Vayamim Harabim Haheim, Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, Vayanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah, Vayizaku, Vatal Shavasam el Helokim min ha'avodah. So Mirza Hashem, I'll talk about the second part of that pasuk tomorrow. How exactly in that pasuk in Shemos do we see the Jewish people davening? How was their anacha, their groans, and their tzaka, and their shava different? There are three different lashonos. But today I want to focus on the first part of the pasuk. Vayihi vayamim harabim haheim, vayamas melech Mitzrayim. It sounds like a very intriguing introduction. Vayamim harabim haheim, those many days. So part of it is just a literary way to describe the nondescript passage of time. Nothing important was happening. Time was just continuing to advance, to move forward. The many, many days. Many days suggest a background of time advancing without any epic or major dramatic events occurring. Those days, those many, many days of history. But obviously the Torah isn't just giving a literary background to demonstrate the passage of time. By stating, Bayamim harabim haheim, the Torah is stressing something about those days. So part of what made those days many, Bayamim harabim haheim, part of what made them many is because it was excruciating. When we're engaged in an enjoyable experience, time flies, time accelerates, time moves quickly. Probably the most familiar example of that in Tanakh is when Yaakov works for Lavan in order to marry Rachel. He works 7 years. Vahi be'enav ki'amim achadim. And those days were like single days. They were like very, very quick days because his excitement, his anticipation was, and he was so eager that the time passed very quickly. Here we see, sadly and tragically, the opposite effect, where time is dragging, where there's no horizons of hope, where day by day more suffering, very reminiscent of the Tochachan Parshas Kisavo, Baboker Tamar Mi'itin Erev, Erev Tamar Mi'itin Boker. In the morning you wake up and you wonder, you worry and wonder and wait for the evening, and you wait in the evening for the morning, and you fear the morning, and you dread the morning, but you want the morning. And when we pay attention to time, and we mark the passage of time, of course time moves a lot slower than when we are focused on some larger project that excites us, and time just is moving in the background. So, the Vayam Harabi Mahim, before any particular reason or idea or function of the slowing of time and the molasses of time, is they were suffering. When you suffer, time moves very slowly. However, there are two other reasons that time moves very slowly, or two other reasons that the Torah refers to this experience as Bayamim Harabim Hahim. One of them is what the Ramban quotes. The Ramban quotes a medrash. It's actually, to find the Ramban, I don't have the Ramban in front of me. If you look at the Ramban, it's on that Pasuk Vayhi, Bayamim Harabim Hahim, Parak Beis, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, that Moshe had fled from Paro and was missing for a longer time than the actual textual flow would suggest. When we read Parsha Shmos, it feels like it's bang, bang. Everything's happening quickly. Moshe challenges Paro's authority. Moshe assassinates the Egyptian who was trying to torture a Jew. Moshe tries to intervene with two combatants, Jewish combatants. We later learn, according to Chazal, it's Dasan and Aviram. There's a boli, as we would say, put out for Moshe. Moshe's a fugitive. He has to run away to Midian. And at some point, he marries Sipora, becomes a shepherd, wanders into the desert, and Hashem sends him back to Mitzrayim. There were 60 years that elapsed between Moshe's fleeing Mitzrayim and his return. How do I know it's 60? Well, Moshe returns and stands in front of Paro, who's 80 years old. And it's hard to place how old is he when he flees, but it seems like Vayigdal, Moshe, he grows up, so that's generally associated with 13. So let's say, and there are different versions in Midrashim, but let's say conservatively, he's between the age of 13 and 20 when all those events happen. And when he kills the Egyptian, when he intervenes in this conflict, and when he flees from Paro. So somewhere between 13 and 20. Now, what's unclear is, does he run immediately to Midian? When he's in Midian, does he stay in Midian? How quickly does he marry Sipora? None of these are clearly defined by the Torah. And there are very colorful midrashim about Moshe traveling outside of Midian to other lands. For our intents and purposes, since we're looking at it through the eyes of the Jewish people, it doesn't make a difference. What makes a difference is that 60 years has elapsed. Now, why is that important? You have to imagine that with Moshe's immediate rebellion against his father, Moshe's killing the Egyptians knew about it, certainly the Jews knew about it, Moshe offered a glimmer of hope. Here's an insider who's been raised in Paro's palace, but he's one of us. And he cares about us, and he has courage, and he has influence, and he cares about our domestic squabbles. And maybe this is the moment we've been waiting for. And that all comes crashing down when he flees, and he remains away from Egypt, outside of Egypt, for 60 years. So for those 60 years, all hope was dashed. People told stories about Moshe. People have told stories about his potential. People have told stories about this revolution that never happened. So the Yamim HaRabim is that pocket of years that we just don't see in the text. And the pocket of years which brought a lot of frustration, because for those 60 years, nothing was happening, nothing was moving, nothing was advancing. So the Torah captures the disillusionment that people felt, and the Torah captures this break in the action, as we would say, by referring to them as Yamim HaRabim HaHeim. The Chizkuni on that pasuk provides a third reason that that period during which the king of Egypt died, Vayamas Melech Vehi Bayamim Harabim Hahim Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, why it's introduced or prefaced with Yamim Harabim Hahim. It refers not to the passage of time or the pocket of time that we don't have too much information about, but it refers to the reason that they began to suffer. It wasn't just the death of the Egyptian king that made them groan and cry and scream, as we'll see tomorrow when Emir Hashem I discuss the second part of the pasuk. But they had miscalculated. Namely, 400 years had already elapsed, and they had a prophecy that they would depart Egypt 400 years after Jewish history was launched. Jewish history presumably was launched at the Bris Ben Abisarim, and 400 years people were counting. And perhaps it was magnified by the death of Paro. So whenever there's political tumult, we just assume, we hope that maybe this is a harbinger and a forerunner to Mashiach. And everyone got excited, and nothing happened. And according to the Chizkuni, because the death of Paro happened 400 years after Bris Ben Abisarim, but the counting of 400 years, as Chazal tell us, begins with the birth of Yitzchak for all sorts of important reasons that I won't elaborate now. It sounds like it's just a mathematical adjustment, but it's an important conceptual adjustment why Jewish history only begins with the birth of Yitzchak, the 400 years term of Mitzrayim. Either way, according to the Chizkuni, the Yamim HaRabim Mahim, the mental anguish and the psychological dread and the frustration, wasn't just a product of the work and the labor and a new king and uncertainty, I'll discuss in a moment. It was because of all the expectations that were raised. And of course, this is a sad part of our history, that whenever messianic expectations are inflamed and aroused and incited and they're not met, it leads to widespread despair and depression and sunken spirit. And of course, the most famous or infamous example is the Shabtai Tzvi in the 17th century, which essentially tore apart Judaism for about 150 years. Again, it laid the groundwork for the emergence of Hasidus, it laid the groundwork for the stabilization of a halachic-based system, which the Vilna Gaon was able to create in Vilna, that became the launching pad for the yeshiva movement. So out of those fissures came some very important aspects of Jewish history and elements of Jewish intellectual history, but it was certainly, at a ground level, it was very corrosive and very splintering for Jewish history and for the Jewish experience. So those are three or four of the reasons that the Torah introduces this whole chapter of the king's death, Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, Vayanchu Bnei Yisrael, why it was so difficult. The Yamim HaRabim Ahim was not just that they were working so hard and time was grinding to a halt, but at least according to the Ramban, it's trying to describe a dark period of radio silence with nothing's really moving, and that's 60 years. Imagine it's 60 years. And according to the Chizkuni, it's because a miscalculation led them to believe. And it's not the only miscalculation, as we know. The Shevet Ephraim left Mitzrayim early, about 30 years early, if I'm not mistaken, and tens of thousands of them were murdered in either in the desert or when they got to Eretz Yisrael. Now, why is the death of the Egyptian king, why is it so difficult for them? Vahi bayam harabim mahim. So again, the simple read is that as difficult as their plight was, and as hard as they worked, there's still a stability in certainty. If you know what tomorrow will bring, if you are able to handle the known, even if the known is dreary, and even if the known is bleak, and even if the known is oppressive, you're able to adjust. Human beings have a great agility to adjust and great resilience. And you don't make peace with it, but at least you're able to digest it and process it and move on. What happens when uncertainty sets in? So just the uncertainty itself is very destabilizing, and the fear of the unknown. There are very different accounts in Chazal, whether they thought he would be a better king and it turned out to be just as bad, or he was worse and he intensified. According to some Rishonim, the previous kings of Mitzrayim didn't have any religious agenda. They were just interested in enslaving the Jews, interested in slave labor. This new king who replaced the old king began religious persecution and religious oppression and pressure to convert to Egyptian paganism. Obviously, these are not explicitly mentioned in the text, but the general feeling of the text is the fear of the unknown, the fear of the next king, the fear of not knowing what will happen, the hopes that are evoked. And when those hopes, again, not messianic hopes necessarily to leave Mitzrayim, but hopes that this new regime and this new administration will be softer, more merciful, more compassionate. And then again, when those hopes are dashed, then depression and frustration sets in and it becomes more difficult. So whenever you change the goal, move the goalposts, as we say, and change the rules of engagement, and you introduce uncertainty, you expect there to be depression and frustration. Of course, we're all familiar with the very graphic Mamar Chazal, that the reason that his death caused such anguish and such misery is because he really didn't die. He had tsaras, and he's not the first Egyptian king to have a tsaras-like experience, nor will he be the last. Remember, one of the Makos Ishchim, which is one of the forms of tsaras, and his medical agents slash sorcerers slash wizards prescribed a very, very grisly therapy, that every morning he should slaughter 150 Jewish babies and bathe in their blood, and in the afternoon repeat the same horrific, grotesque experience. And of course, this caused great, great, great anguish, great misery, great terror. Now, I want to talk about two things. I want to say one thing very sensitively, and the other thing more as an outsider, but I want to talk about the sensitive issue first. I'm now 58 years old, so let's say I've read this Haggadah as an adult, probably close to 45 years, and read about this story about slaughtering the babies and the blood, and about throwing babies into the Nile River, and the Mamar Chazal that when the Jews were short on bricks, they had to replace those bricks with their own babies, not willfully, but these images of babies being torn apart from their parents and thrown into the wall in place of bricks. And to be honest with you, it was just so grotesque and so horrific and so unimaginable that it just didn't compute. You read about it, but certain things are just so beyond the pale that even when you mention them, right, the big challenge of mentioning ideas is to try to internalize them and to live them and to identify with them and to visualize them rather than just to parrot them and to recite them. And these images were just so unimaginable to me. What does it mean to put a baby into a wall? Could you imagine that? What does it mean to slaughter 150 babies and have their blood collected? What does it mean to throw a baby into a river? Somehow violence against adults, even wanton arbitrary violence, is something that at least we can visualize. And because we can visualize it, we can experience it and engage with it emotionally. And now it's Pesach 2024, and unfortunately, after October 7th, sadly, these images are no longer unimaginable. We faced such unspeakable horror, such unconditional evil, and we saw what Yimach Shemam, these horrific subhuman beings, did to babies. And we saw the pictures of blood spread across wherever they were, whether it was the gathering in Nova or in the kibbutzim, that... I'm not saying this, obviously, with any degree of triumph. Chas v'shalom, obviously, I don't mean triumph, but of any degree of satisfaction, that now it means something to me. But just, it's Erev Pesach, and just think about these images, maybe this year, in ways that we just couldn't think about them in previous years, and commiserate and live the pain that our nation is experiencing through the prism, through the lenses of our previous experience in Mitzrayim, in which, sadly, we face the same type of brutal, inhuman... The only other reference point I think about is a medrash about the first Beis HaMikdash, where as we were leaving Yerushalayim and fleeing Nebuchadnezzar, we came across a stone, and there were 300 skulls of babies. And of course, Chazal, part of the Eichas, we ask Hashem to take revenge. And just these horrific images of somehow... violence against babies, against infants, it's beyond any ability to compute. And we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be Nokim Nikmas Am Yisrael and to take revenge from these beasts who just pour out wrath against little, not even children, but infants. And that's the issue that hit me most powerfully this year. In a broader sense, if you take a few steps back, and it's not 2024, and it's not the suffering that our people have experienced, but there is a second part to this story, and that's just to see the horrid, ridiculous, paganistic witchcraft. Why in the world Would anyone believe that there's medicinal value to bathing in blood? Why in the world would that be helpful? It doesn't soothe. There are other ways to soothe. I know, you know, when you have hives or something, so it's very hot, but blood is also hotter than water, and they had plenty of water. This was before Makas Dam, and it was just so strange and bizarre and doesn't have any basis in medicine and does have basis in witchcraft and in sorcery and in paganism and in blood rituals and blood rites. And this whole episode where Paro slaughters 150 babies just reminds us again about how dark and unenlightened and this world of black magic that we were living in and that we were suffering under and that we had to be exposed to on a daily basis, and that we, it's when we think of slavery, we reverse engineer what it would be like to be a slave in 21st century terms. But there's so much more to this culture that was oppressive, that was corrosive, that was morally decrepit and degenerate, and that we were forced to absorb through hundreds of years, and in particular in slavery, we were exposed to. When we're free men, you make cultural decisions, what you want to be exposed to, what you don't. You live in Goshen, and you decide not to attend the pagan witchcraft party, which they're sacrificing animals, eating mushrooms, and drinking blood. But as a slave, you're the attendant. You have to attend that party, and you have to work for that party. You have to bring the animals, and maybe they'll drink your... It's just, aside from the national trauma that we suffer that makes these images so much more powerful and potent, just imagine this horrible world of black magic that we're exposed to. I just want to end with one final point, and that is, just keep in mind that in Shmos, we encounter four pyros. There's the pyro that begins Shmos, and then there's Vayaka Melech Hadash, so there's a new pyro, sorry, three, a new pyro, and then that pyro dies, Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, Vahi Bayimim Harabim Mahim Vayamas Melech Mitzrayim, and pyro number two, who is the Melech Hadash, who dies, is replaced by a third pyro. Now, why is this important? In those days, Pyro was the supreme monarch, and he didn't have elections every 4 years. He reigned for his entire life with an iron fist. He wasn't replaced. He was the Pyro. And again, we don't know about how long Parsha Shmos is chronologically, as I mentioned before. There's at least a 60-year pocket somewhere in the middle. But at least from a narrative standpoint, from a literary standpoint, in a very short time, literarily, again, not on the calendar, but literarily, there is a quick succession of kings, and there's a lot of political upheaval and turmoil, not insurrection, because these are totalitarian regimes, but because people are dying or new kings are arising. We don't know how the new king is come by, Gamelech Hadash. Why is this important? Because anytime you get close to redemption, to Gulas Yisrael, history starts to accelerate, and in the acceleration of history, there's a lot of political destabilizing or instability and movement, and it's quicksand, because as history reaches either its final endpoint or particular junctures, it has to account for itself, and evil people have to be punished, just people have to be rewarded. There has to be, it's like April 15th for Americans, there has to be an accounting, and everything has to be squared, and everything has to be rounded out. And you're seeing it for the first time, but not the last time in Mitzrayim, where the political tumult and the instability indicates that history is moving forward and that history is trying to reach either its endpoint or a particular juncture, a redemptive juncture in history. You see this in Shushan, where over the course of 70, 80 years, how many kings rose and fell, Nebuchadnezzar and Evel Merodach and Belshazzar and Dariavash and Koresh and Achashverosh and Dayavash, and it's just such a quick turnaround. Everything's happening so quickly because Gula is in the air, because 70 years after we left, we have to be returned. And we believe that the same phenomena is occurring in our day, and all the instability of the late 19th century, but of course of the 20th century and the 21st century, and all the states that rise and fall, and all the maps that are drawn and redrawn, and all the world wars that are fought, part of it, because it augurs the entry into a era in which redemption will, emirat Hashem, happen very quickly. So aside from the actual message of the Haggadah, the Yamas Melech Mitzrayim, the larger picture, and the combination of these quick turnarounds are indicative of a larger redemptive process.